I'm Mindy Greiling, and I am the chair of the Education Finance Committee, and I represent 10 minutes north of the Capitol in Roseville, St. Anthony Village, and Lauderdale. And in a minute, we'll have the other legislators introduce themselves as well. But first, I would just like to welcome you all. We are thrilled to walk in this room and see so many people who are interested in education and students like we are. And we were worried in August that it might be a sparse crowd, but clearly you have done well with attendance here. We're going to, first of all, in the format for tonight is to have our nonpartisan staff person go through a short PowerPoint that tells some of the highlights of the session this year. And then he will go through the bill, which we're dubbing the New Minnesota Miracle for school funding, so that you can have a thumbnail sketch of it before you give us your testimony. And then after we go through that, we will go through testifiers at the microphone if you filled out a green card. And so far, I'll give you a hint, we only have three. So if you do want to talk, you have a good chance to be able to do it if you fill out a green card. And Shannon, where are the green cards?
We have them out here, or I can bring some around to people, and there's some on the tables too.
Okay. On the tables, you could raise your hand, or they're up here. And you know, ideally, we like each person to talk for 3 minutes or so we can hear from a lot of people. And we do end at 8:30, right on the dot, because we find that a lot of people would rather talk to us afterwards informally. So we want to leave time for that as well when we're done with the formal meeting. So right now, I will have the other legislators introduce themselves, and we will save the best for last, your own local legislator, so he can make some other introductions in the room. But if we could start right down at that end. And I guess I have to send the microphone down, don't I?
Good evening. My name is Carlos Maduari. I'm a state representative from St. Paul. I live just across the river from downtown St. Paul, so I get up in the morning, I get to look at downtown, I get to look at the Capitol, and then reality sets in, I get to walk to the Capitol and deal with the Capitol. It's a pleasure to be here today. I have the privilege of chairing the E-12 House Policy Committee, and I'm really looking forward to learning about this great community. I know that you roughly have about 2,000 students enrolled in the public schools here, and about a third of them are students that come from households that are struggling economically. And so dealing with issues of poverty and low income and education is something that we find very common around the state. To be about education is in many ways to be about also helping families to struggle up through the economic ladder. And so I'd be interested to hear more about your experiences with that, because we need every young person in this state to be successful. So I look forward to listening and learning from you all. Thank you for hosting us today.
Good evening. My name is Denise Dietrich, and I represent the suburbs of Champlin and Coon Rapids. They are both of them about 20 miles north of the Twin Cities. I represent the school district, the Anoka-Hennepin School District, which is about 40,000 students. So that's a little bit of a contrast to the size of your school district, but I am really looking forward to listening to you and discovering the similarities and differences, even though the size might be different. So thank you for having us.
Hi, I'm Bernie Leader, and I represent Polk, Marshall, Red Lake, and all of Pennington except the city of Thief River. So I'm glad to be here and see what's going on.
I'm Neil Stumpf, state senator for Senate District 1, which is the northwest corner. Okay, I'm Gary Dolan. I'm the representative from this district,
So I have Thief River and everything basically north of here. Not quite, I don't have all of it because I don't have the western part of Marshall County, but one thing that I would want to say before I start introducing a few other people is education finance reform is an issue that we have been struggling with at the legislature many years before I got on the legislature, and obviously an issue that we've been struggling with the last 2 years while I've been on the legislature. We need to make some major changes in how we're doing things, and Mindy has a plan here that will make major changes. This committee of hers, which is an outstanding committee, has spent a lot of time working on putting this plan together. So hopefully you can get some ideas of what we can maybe do in the future and things that would be in the best interest of this area and this state as a whole. So with that, I'm not going to make any other further comments on that other than I have a few. One thing I want to do, and this may not be the foolproof way of doing it, but just to get an idea how many school districts are here, I want the superintendents in the audience to raise their hand. I may miss somebody that way, but I... I knew there were a lot of you out there, and there may be somebody that's representing a school district that doesn't have a superintendent, but I knew a lot of superintendents came in the door, and that's the reason I did that. Just to get a flavor of how many different people that are here. A lot of them are from my district, not all of them, obviously. Some of you are Bernie's district, and there might be some from even further that I didn't even notice. Well, I know there is. There's one gentleman I saw from Twin Valley, at least, that's here, so I know that's down to Kent's district. But with that, I'm not going to make any further comments other than I'm going to turn it over to Superintendent Irv Peterson of the Thief River Falls School District so he can introduce his school board or anyone else that he may want to introduce.
Thank you. Welcome to our school district. Welcome to Lincoln High School, Thief River Falls School District. We're happy to be able to host this meeting tonight. We're especially pleased that so many representatives and Senator Stumpall able to make it to this meeting tonight. Education funding reform is very necessary. We certainly applaud the efforts of Representative Greiling and others who have been working on this for many, many hours, many, many days, many, many weeks, and it goes into years now. Since some studies have been done in the last several years. But I would like to, again, welcome you to our district here. I would like to introduce the school board members from Thief River Falls, our hosting district here. And we've got Jenny Erickson Lane is here, Troy Bates, and our chair, Barb Kalinowski, is here, and Randy Twistle in the back. And do we have any others? Okay. But we certainly appreciate all the other support that's here from all the other school districts in northwestern Minnesota, because when we bring these people this far north from St. Paul, we want to show them that we truly are folks up here who are very, very interested in all of their work. Thank you very much.
Boy, we're really impressed with all the education people that are here, so I'm sure we're going to get good input. And I am very, very pleased that we have with us other local legislators. Representative Leader is just the dean of the House of Representatives. He is probably gets more standing ovations than any single member of the House that we have ever had. And I take a lot of counsel from him on things like transportation, because he has done with transportation what we're trying to do with this bill with education. He came up with a winning formula that was fair to the whole area of the state, and then we got enough legislators bipartisanly to pass it. And that's what we need to do for education. We're taking our Representative Leader's model and trying to emulate it on behalf of our students. And then Senator Stump, who I didn't see over there when I was starting to say we have the best for last, the local legislator. We have the two best local legislators here. And Senator Stump and I worked very closely together this year, and the achievements for this session that Greg Crow, our staff person, is going to go through shortly, never would have happened if the Senate and the House hadn't worked closely together and the leadership of Senator Stump, who came and got me along with his main staff person and my main staff person and said, quick, you know, we need to work quickly on behalf of students and be very organized together or we're going to get lost in the shuffle. And so I was so glad, because I'm a new chair, to take counsel from him so that we were able to do what we did. And so thank you, Senator Stump. I know it wouldn't have happened if you hadn't come and got us. And it worked, so I'm going to remember that for every other year when we're trying to work for students. What we are going through tonight, like I said, we're going to have some general information before we have your testimony. And what we're trying to do with this, what we're calling the new Minnesota miracle, is to have, we took the report that PS Minnesota came out with, and since we have so many school board members and superintendents, you know what that is. But in case there's anybody here that's not familiar with that, it's the Public Schools Minnesota Report, almost all the major education groups in the state that took the governor's task force on education finance, moved the ball down the road and gave it to the legislature, and then we had a bipartisan Senate House Education Finance Study Group co-chaired by myself and Senator Terry Bonnoff, Commissioner Alice Segrin, and we came up with this bill that we're now vetting across the state so that we can possibly perfect it and change it if we need to or add some things. We already have a list, and we'll probably get some more things here tonight. We've generally, the major things we've done is we have more adequate funding because, you know, we haven't kept up with inflation over the last decade plus. And then we have more equitable funding for the different types of students, the different types of districts, so that everybody's on an even keel with whatever challenges they might have that funding could help with. And then we link it all to inflation so that it's more stable and predictable, something PS Minnesota called for. And then we have it, finally, the last point I want to make is that it's scalable. You probably know we're staring at a big deficit when we go into session next year, but our fiscal staff is very, very talented and bright, and they came up with a package that I like to liken to the Eiffel Tower, excuse me, because it is a beautiful proportional structure, and we could have a big Eiffel Tower like the one that we all know, and some of us have visited. I haven't, but I wish I had. Or we could have a little model that fit right here on our desk, or we could have something in between based on how much funding that we put into it. And then we can add to it each session as we are able. You know, I kind of envision it will take three bienniums to fund it. And I think we just plain have to start this year no matter what the deficit, because the best way to grow our economy and to get our state back on track is to invest in education. And that would include higher education. When we've done that in previous decades, then more jobs are here, people earn better wages, that contributes more to the economy, and it just boils over in a very nice way. When we don't invest, then our state becomes stagnated and we have a lesser economy. And so even with the deficit, our state economist tells us that's one way to get out of it, is to start with things like this. So I'm going to turn it over now to Greg Crow, who's one of our nonpartisan fiscal staff, who will go through the PowerPoint, and then it will be your turn. So thank you very much, and Mr. Crow.
Thank you. I'll quickly run through this PowerPoint. It looks like I got it going. Down. There we go. Down is up. All right. So we start with a couple of highlights of the 2008 legislative session. For fiscal 2009, the legislature added $51 per pupil to your general education revenue on a one-time basis. I believe if you came through and grabbed a printout that's on a portrait style printout, it lists each district and how much that $51 per pupil amounts to for those districts. In addition, there was an authorization of up to $51 per pupil from the reserved operating capital account to general fund for school districts. The legislature increased the lease levy from $100 to $150 per pupil and authorized the levy to replace some money lost due to an audit of federal funds and collaborative time study. Wrong way again. Alright. Then for 2010 and later, the legislature removed the general education aid offset of permanent school fund money. Basically, districts, the general fund accumulated interest off of the permanent school fund, and that interest was used to reduce the amount of funding the state had to pay school districts. Now, instead of reducing that payment, the permanent school fund money will be added to district revenue and should grow over time as the principal and interest grows in the permanent school fund. This amounts to roughly $30 million or about $30 per pupil compared to the 51 on the first slide. As Representative Grannon indicated, there have been a few studies of school finance and education finance reform, so I'll leave you to read this slide at your own leisure. The result of those was the goals of House File 4178, which is to create adequate funding that's equitable, more fair, simplified, and then, as Representative Grannon indicates, scalable, to allow that funding change reform to be phased in over time. So the characteristics in broad strokes, and we'll discuss each of these in detail as we move through this, are a basic per pupil formula that is high enough to cover the basic instructional needs of districts to pay for basic instruction of students, and then additional formulas that go above and beyond that for different needs. Then a full funding of the state's share of special education costs. Now, this wouldn't completely eliminate the cross subsidy because it would be full funding of the 68% of salaries in the state funding formula. Then there are increased options for facility needs and increased equalization in the property tax system, as well as property tax relief. Let's go to the details on slide 8. Initially, for simplification purposes, all students will be counted as 1.0 pupil unit. Students, including kindergartners, which are now counted at about 0.612 of a pupil unit, will be counted as 1. And we currently have pupil weightings that range from 1 to 1.3 for pupils in elementary and high school grades. Those would all be weighted at 1. The current practice of funding students based on where they're served would continue. One note here, as we change the pupil weighting to 1, we lose about 10 to 15% of the students in the state. So as we talk about the basic formula in the next slide, the basic formula has increased from 5,124 to 7,500. Part of that increase, you know, the first 10 to 15%, about $500 to $700, was added simply to hold school districts harmless. In other words, there were fewer students, so the formula had to be raised to generate the same revenue to school districts. The $7,500 figure is as a result of some research that was done in one of the previous studies, and they had generated a cost of educating a student to the level that would meet the state testing needs, and so that number was, and that number was a 2003 number, so then it was inflated to be a 2009 number. And then in addition to setting that at the higher $7,500 per pupil, that formula amount would be indexed, and the rate of inflation that would be used would be the implicit price deflator for state and local services. Then beyond the basic formula, there would be continued additional funding for certain specific needs. We currently have a compensatory revenue formula that provides additional funding to districts that have more low-income students. What House File 4178 would do would be basically set a floor of $2,500 or 33% of the formula allowance, and that would adjust if the formula allowance changes. And then there would be a concentration factor that would allow for higher revenue in districts with higher concentrations of those students. And that concentration factor would be calculated at the district level rather than the site level as it is now. And what that does is the current curve of revenue starts up pretty low and rapidly escalates as concentration increases. This would basically bring the whole curve up to be a flat line at 2,500 or 33% of the formula for those districts with lower concentrations, and then the slope of the line would be quite as high. Then for districts with pupils of limited English proficiency, currently the funding formula for LEP is a fixed dollar amount, and there's a concentration amount and a separate general LEP funding amount. This proposal would link that LEP funding amount to 20% of the formula allowance, so it would change as the basic formula went up. And currently there's a limit of 5 years of funding for any individual student, and that would be eliminated under 4178. In addition, as part of creating the 1.0 pupil units, we lose what we currently have for declining enrollment with the calculation of 77% of last year's pupils, or 77% of this year's pupils plus 23% of last year's pupil, generating a different pupil count. So instead of having a declining enrollment revenue embedded into the pupil count, there would be a separate declining enrollment formula. And it would be used, would be calculated based on a 3-year average of enrollment. And an additional formula that would be established is called Location Equity Index, or LEI. And what this does is account for higher costs of living in high cost counties. And it's based on wage and housing data. It's 50% of the basic formula allowance times the greater of 1 or the county index for that school district. And so whatever county the school district's headquarters are located in would generate the formula, the county index. And currently only the 7 county metro area generates a index greater than 1. So all the other counties would be at the 1 for their county index. Under sparsity revenue. Currently, sparsity revenue obviously goes to small geographically isolated school districts. What 4178 does is lower the minimum sparsity district from 19 to 15 miles, which would increase revenue to those types of districts. And basically, the rest of the sparsity formula would stay the same. In addition, an innovation revenue category is established. It's 1.5% of the basic revenue, and it's reserved to fund research-based practices to improve academic performance. And if a district isn't making adequate progress, they have to file a plan with the Department of Education for the use of the revenue. They would still get it, but there would be some oversight as to how it was spent in order to help student achievement. There are other reserves, some that are in current law and some that are new. Rather than having a separate gifted and talented program, 1% of basic revenue would be set aside for that. 0.5% in addition to the current levy for career and technical would be set aside. And then the existing reserves for basic skills, operating capital, and staff development would be retained. In terms of simplification, there are several revenue components that are eliminated, including training experience revenue, equity revenue, transition revenue, pension offset revenue, gifted and talented revenue, and QComp revenue. On the referendum side, there is a separate $500 amount that looks basically like basic formula to school districts. It would be $500 of general education revenue increase, and then each school district would have up to $500 of its referendum revenue eliminated. So if a district is below $500, all of their referendum revenue would be taken away. Districts at $1,000, for example, their new referendum revenue would be $500. on special education, the statewide special education cap is eliminated, so the 68% of salary cost formula would be fully funded. In addition, the statewide cap on excess cost revenue would be eliminated, so that formula would be fully funded. As it relates to pupil transportation, we don't have a transportation formula now, as you all know, but a new hazardous pupil transportation formula would be created. State aid would be provided to districts who determine that they have hazardous conditions, and those conditions are limited to not exceed 20% of the district's existing to and from transportation costs. In addition, 5% of the district's total transportation costs would be an additional 5% calculated off the district's transportation costs would be sent to the district to use for bus purchases. On the facility side, currently large school districts have the ability to levy for deferred maintenance without voter approval. This 4178 would allow all districts to do that. In addition, debt service equalization aid would be increased to help districts to increase their ability to pass bond issues. And in addition, there's a new agricultural school bond credit in order that will reduce ag taxes in order to help districts with high concentrations of agricultural land pass building referendums. In addition, on the property tax side, in addition to the $500 reduction on the referendum, there is increased equalization for the school funding formulas. The equalizing factors are indexed to the statewide growth in the tax base, and there are total school taxes reduced by the elimination of levies for operating capital equity transition, QCOMP, and the $500 we talked about before. This last slide is really small and hard to read, but basically it shows in each of these components how much additional revenue there is. So if you look at the first line, basic revenue is currently, for the basic formula, about $4.9 billion. Under House File 4178, it would be about $6.2 billion for an increase of about $1.3 billion in added revenue to school districts. And you can see that in all categories. Some strange things happen. For example, in declining enrollment level, revenue currently, we don't, under current law, we don't have a separate formula, so it shows up as a zero, even though we know districts are receiving revenue because their enrollment is declining, and so that shows up as an additional $73 million. The last slide just gives you some places to find additional information about school finance, about House File 4178. Finally, there was a handout to a horizontal handout on legal paper that says general education revenue fiscal 2009 baseline versus alternative on the top of it. And what that is a comparison of base revenue versus what would happen on the House File 4178. And you can basically look at your school district and see what happens in terms of additional revenue because of House File 4178.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pro. And now we will go to testifiers. And the first one is Superintendent Peterson. And I just want to take a moment before we hear from him to thank him and his staff for helping us organize this hearing. And also I'd like to thank Representative Olin, because he has worked closely with our committee staff to arrange this hearing. And he also has, even though he doesn't serve on the committee, he's been very much encouraging of having a hearing in your area so we could be sure to hear from the types of districts that you represent. Even though it is a long drive, we need to, because you're an important part of our state. And he's a big backer of education and students in our caucus. We need the members who are not on the committee to help as well when we're battling for funding, and he certainly joins us in this. So thank you, too, Representative Olin. Superintendent Peterson.
Thank you very much. I would concur that we have a
system that definitely needs an overhaul, and I applaud you for the efforts that you've put into this so far. There's so much variation in our funding system throughout the districts, throughout the state at this time. According to the most recent statewide data from the Minnesota Department of Education, and this is two-year-old data, but the average revenue in a general fund per student is a little over $9,000, $9,073 two years ago. And Tinker Falls revenue per student for that same year in general education is $8,541. So we're $532 below the state average. And for our 2,000 students, that's well over $1 million per year. And most regional centers across the state are in similar situations, funded below the state average. I checked 20 different regional centers around the state, from the northeast over here to the northwest and down to the central part of the state, southwest, southeast. And of those 20 districts, they're an average of over $300 below the state average. So it's kind of a trend or a vast majority of regional centers that were funded considerably below the state average. And just of those 20 districts that I checked, there's nearly $2,000 difference between the higher funded ones and the lower funded ones. $2,000 per student. So I mean, that's just another example of the disparity among districts. You talked about in this presentation the location equity index, and that's going to be an item for the a lot of school districts in the metro area or the seven county metro area. I'm just wondering if there's any way that regional centers throughout the state that are not part of the metro area would be able to get any sort of extra relief. We certainly don't qualify for sparsity revenue, and so we're at kind of a disadvantage with all of our neighbors and everything too. And this is not just something for Thief River Falls, but for many districts around the state. Nearly all districts in the state, as you know, have an operating levy, and you have a provision there to reduce those on the local taxpayers by $500 per pupil. I can remember back about 7 or 8 years when we did this same thing, but we didn't have a funding stream for it. So I hope that in the whole formula this time around, we've got something to make that sustainable across the state. And certainly a proposal to bring about $600 million worth of property tax relief would be greatly appreciated by all of us, all of the school districts and all of our property owners. As this proposal hopefully moves forward in discussions, I would certainly welcome opportunities to bring local stories to the committees in St. Paul as new opportunities, as these runs and everything change a little bit. But I certainly would hope that we can find some sort of relief for regional centers around the state as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much. Okay, Darren Stender and Amy Erickson. They're on the same card, so, and I know you usually come up together too, so. They're some of our star testifiers at the Capitol.
That's okay. Pretty bad when they know it's my first name. I'm Amy Erickson, and I'm a parent from the Frazee Burger School District.
And I'm Darren Stender, superintendent of the Frazee Burger School District. I'm going to let Amy go first today. She's driving the short end of the stick.
I don't know how many of you are aware, like you said, and they mentioned about the provision about the referendums, and we are in a predicament right now in Frazee where we have petitioners who are seeking to revoke our referendum. And as I've testified in the past, the terror that it has raised in our community is ripping people apart. We were even discussing on the way up here how it's pitted even sons against fathers, and it's very hard. And now, with this petition starting all over again, we were all rejoicing and celebrating that we finally had some extra revenue, and the voting had been put on the local districts, and so when we finally do get our communities to step up to the plate, then suddenly this is being taken away from us. So I applaud the work that you're doing with the Minnesota Miracle. I think it's going to be very supportive throughout the whole state of Minnesota, which is fantastic. I'm not speaking only for Frazee, but I worry what the ramifications will be should our referendum be revoked. It will, the 92% of the schools are going to be in the same position, because to only have to have 15% of your voting population sign a petition to get it on the ballot again is a crime. So I ask you also to do what you can to look at that. Look at that law, either repeal it or increase the percentage of persons. It's not right that 15% should have a say that will affect a vast majority of our future in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you.
I guess I kind of want to reflect on what Amy said. It is correct. Our community is struggling right now. It's been a seven-year struggle. We've been six consecutive years with the referendum, finally passing it last fall. And to have petitioners circulate a petition where 15%, it's not a registered voters, it's eligible voters. And think about that. As representatives, you probably have 15% of your population in your representative districts that may not be happy with the decisions that you're making, to be able to petition to remove you from office. We fear that we will lose our funding. How do you plan and prepare a budget? How do you move forward in the future when you don't know what's going to happen? And then there's the side effects of that. A community that's torn will be scarred for a very, very long time. Right now, the petition is in the Attorney General's office for review to verify if the petition actually is valid in terms of the question. And if that decision is rendered before September 12th, we'll put the question on the ballot, not by choice of the school board, but by force of the law. The Minnesota Miracle, the proposal that you have in front of you that you've been presenting, is great. It brings equity to the rural school districts, and we feel that and we need that. If you can get the referendum, the $500, that will, without any property tax relief, that in itself will probably make a lot of people quite happy. I know in our district, two things that they were doing, they were circulating a petition to reduce it to $500, and they were circulating another petition to revoke it, and they were circulating another petition to call on the district to have an audit. Well, the one that got the most signatures was the petition to revoke the referendum, which is the one they filed on the school district on July 30th. And so that's the situation of Frazee. But I don't want to just talk about Frazee. When I come and speak in front of you, I want to speak about all schools across the state of Minnesota, because it's about education. It's about kids. Whether I'm the superintendent of Frazee or any other school district, I want the best for them. And everybody's in the same situation. Everybody is a Frazee, or they will be a Frazee, or on the brink of being a Frazee. My neighbor to the east is over here in Lake Park, Ottawa, dealing with some of the same struggles over there with the voting population. And that's what we all face. Anybody who's going to seek or put a question on the ballot is going to face some struggles with the population, the voter population. They're not happy, the times aren't right, things aren't going well. And I ask you to continue to support, and I hope that this is a success. And like the superintendent over here said, we would be more than happy to come down and provide testimony. And just one more thing I'm going to ask. If you will come to Frazee and do what you're doing here, and what you've done in Brainerd, and what you're going to do in Bemidji and Nashwauk and in other areas of the state, if you would please come to Frazee, I think there's people there who would like to listen, would like to see what you're proposing, and I know the area superintendents and people in our region would also like to see that and be a part of that. So I welcome you to Frazee, and I'm probably going to contact you either tonight after this meeting or tomorrow to again extend that invitation to you. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. We are going to as many places as we can, because I just feel like this is the most important education bill that we've had since I've been in the legislature. So we really want to get it right, and then we want to make sure we pass it and get it working. So the next people are Next person, Barb Kalinowski? No, Kalinowski, okay.
Hi, I'm Barb Kalinowski, and I am the chair of our school district school board here in Beverly Hills, and also a regional library director. I know that you talk to regional library directors, and I'm one of the 12. And I read the bill earlier today and was real happy to see the funding streams that are in it, like 1% is set aside for gifted and talented, and the fact that you do have some money in there for innovative revenue. But the piece I didn't see was technology. And, of course, I'm wondering why. But our school district just passed a brand new curriculum development cycle that has technology in it so that we can recognize technology along with everything else that you recognize in developing new curriculum. We don't have the money, of course, for that. It's very difficult to get the labs that are needed. It's some classrooms have whiteboards, most don't. You know the cost of software and the software licenses and all that that has to do with technology. And I just happened to go to a workshop that was done by David O'Brien from the U of M, and he talked about the importance of digital literacy with kids. A lot of the struggling readers, of course, have to have books on CD or books on tape because that's how they learn words, is hearing them first and then being able to speak them later. And so it's not just the technology and computers and software, but also just the small pieces, books on CD. Even in the public libraries, our Highlock librarian this summer mentioned that parents are coming in to get books on CD to play in the vans as they're on vacation or as they're taking the children from one sport event to another. I look at that as a very good thing rather than having the DVDs playing in the vans and all listening, the children listening to books on CD. I believe that public libraries have a very important role in helping with literacy, not only in our programming, but making the AR books available for parents that come in and want those books for their children. So going back to curriculum and technology, I'm just wondering about that. And then when Irv talked about sparsity revenue, I just want to put another plug into that too, because we really, we're a regional center and we're the only school in our area that cannot provide all day, everyday kindergarten. We have made cuts in our budget and we are trying to find a means to fund it within, but it's very, very difficult. So we need to have some work done on that. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. And while we're looking to see if other people would like to testify, we don't have any other green cards. I can answer her question about the technology. This year, when PS Minnesota came forward with their report, we tried to incorporate as many of their requests and suggestions into this bill as we could. And one of them was to have a stable source of funding for technology. And we thought, in the House at least, we thought we had that covered this year with a bill that we had that we didn't end up prevailing on in the end. So we didn't get funding for technology, so we need to keep on working on it. Representative Dietrich had a bill with the permanent school fund money that we did pass this year, and her bill had dedicated it to technology, which would be a permanent stream and likely to increase with the mineral development. But with all the funding needs, that did not prevail this time. But so we need to go back to the drawing board and try to find a stable source for funding for technology, whether it's that one or something in this bill, because that was a tenet put forward by PS Minnesota that we did think was important. And so I'm glad you brought that up. Thank you very much. So, with all these superintendents and school board members, I am sure someone else wants to talk to us. Because you know what? We can talk. Come right up.
George Hanson, Lancaster, Minnesota School District. One thing I did notice here tonight is, and I don't know how much in this forum you want to get into it, but the political reality of your bill. I don't see any Republicans on the dais here, and I'm just wondering, if you could speak to the political realities of trying to push this forward. I don't think anybody in this room is going to argue with 20 to 40% increases to their general revenue streams. And then just given the light of what Representative Hamilton has gone through with Mr. Leader's bill, if the water's been poisoned at all for veto overrides in the House. Thank you.
Thank you, and that's a very salient question. Well, you know, this is the first hearing that we've had where we haven't had bipartisan representation up here at the table, and I think possibly because it's August and it's such a distance and it's election year for House members, you know, maybe all those factors may have played in. We do have the Republican staff person for the committee that's here with us. This report that we put together with the Senate and the House was bipartisanly worked on and bipartisanly signed. All the Democrats that worked on it signed it, and all the Republicans that worked on it signed it. The last hearing that we had was in White Bear Lake with Representative Carol McFarland, who's a Republican who was on the committee. And when she and I and others got school board MSBA awards last week, Representative Dietrich, Representative Stump, a lot of us who work on education, Representative McFarland talked when she was accepting her award that she had helped to work on this and signed it, and she said that was a big step for a member of the minority because of, like you said, there isn't great encouragement for working bipartisanly in the House right at the moment. So we are hopeful, though, because education has always been a bipartisan topic, and I would hate to think that it would start to get to be partisan. What makes it hard is not the partisanness of education, but the no new taxes part of the total pie. We have gone down from 15% of our state and local revenue being invested in our state to 15% over the time that we've been tracking the price of government since the early 90s. And that means that even though you know, the revenue has gone up somewhat, we haven't kept up with inflation or with the incomes rising in our state. We aren't investing as much as the last generation did in our students. And, you know, so that's what's really hampering us. And that is sometimes a partisan issue, and sometimes it's, you know, there's a lot of legislators that are nervous about raising that amount of revenue that we're spending on government. So that's maybe hampering us more than anything. And but I know that the first Minnesota miracle didn't pass in 1 year. It took 3 years to pass it. Governor Wendy Anderson was in office, and he said he would come and talk anywhere if anybody wanted to talk about how that happened. But he campaigned on the issue, and it became, you know, just kind of a march to doing the right thing by students. And it, even then, the legislature was in session way longer than they should have adjourned because it took that long to get enough legislators to have enough courage. But it's happened because it was so needed and such a movement. And so that's kind of, I'm thinking of this as a real long-term effort. And if we don't work really hard on it, despite the deficit, despite the political climate, when we know that our students need this so much, then shame on us. So we have to try. And I'm actually pretty optimistic because we haven't been anywhere where we haven't had rave reviews. Legislators are talking about it. In my district, where I am asking for this is a large ask. My Republican opponent is bashing me for not spending enough on education. So I think everybody knows that it's the political thing to do to be for education, but we have to watch. We have to not let ourselves be divided. Well, we need a new formula, or we need to do this, or we need to do that. Here, because of PS Minnesota, we now do have legislation that all the areas of the state can agree upon. We have to, you know, work on the fine details and, you know, talk about the regional centers or the technology or things. But we have a framework that I think everybody can agree upon. And with fine-tuning when we introduce it next year, I don't think we can be divided on this is the right thing to do. And then, you know, that's how they get us lots of times, get the suburbs against the rural or the metro against the greater Minnesota, or
you know, the core city against the suburbs or whatever it is, if we're all fighting each other, then other budgets move in. And so this is a way to be united. United we stand. We all know that one. So we have another card. And so anybody that wants to speak after, you can see I'm starting to call on the other legislators, and they talk as much as I do if we don't have four cards. I'm going to let, can you pronounce that? Mary Nestacomer. Welcome. Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you very much. I work for an organization called Northwest Links, which is a consortium of 70 school districts and 4 public library systems here in Northwest Minnesota. And I just wanted to piggyback on Ms. Kalinowski's comments about technology and the importance of technology in our schools, and ask that I very much applaud what you are trying to do here with the Minnesota Miracle, because our schools definitely do need some relief and some help. One of the things I have noticed in my several years of working with school districts, previously in my capacity at the Minnesota Department of Education and now with my job at Northwest Links, is school districts are rapidly losing their school library media specialists as well. And I think that putting some additional funding out there and equalizing funding for school districts may help that situation. And those people can be very critical to helping our students achieve 21st century learning skills and the types of information and technology literacy they're going to need to succeed in both higher education and the world of work. And then secondly, I would just like to ask you not to forget the importance of the Internet Access Telecommunications Equity Aid Program for schools and the Regional Library Telecommunications Access Aid. That provides some key funding that helps our schools stay connected to the Internet and our libraries connected to the Internet. And as you know, the Internet is absolutely necessary for doing business these days, no matter what kind of organization you are. So I would appreciate your attention and support of those items as well. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Anyone else? While we're waiting, I'll fill in some more time. I'll just say that the librarians did come and meet with me last week, and they are working with our fiscal staff to figure out a way to tie in library funding to the Minnesota Miracles. And, you know, maybe that will be something will come out of that for technology. We'll see. But they don't want to be an outlier so that it doesn't keep up with the other parts of the formula. And technology, of course, for where we are right now is even more important because the distance learning opportunities. Okay, Representative Mariani is going to talk. If you want to get more green cards, legislators talk.
Excellent. Well, this will probably get a bunch of people up here because they'll want me to stop talking. I just want to say something about the innovation revenue component. It's not tied, in our minds, it's not tied to the NCLB AYP proficiency status. It would be interesting to hear from you your thoughts about how NCLB is working or not working and what kind of concerns or things you celebrate about NCLB and the AYP. We spent a lot of time in our policy committee this last year developing something that would that could coexist with the NCLB framework in terms of an accountability tool that was first and foremost meant to be diagnostic and ultimately helpful to schools. And so what we're we need to flesh this out some more, but what we're proposing with the innovation revenue isn't so much based on whether you need AYP or not that you'll get these additional funds. Roughly right now, maybe that would mean half our schools wouldn't get them, unless they get the plan with the school district. What we did is we engaged some of the best, frankly, some of the best folks from a variety of school districts, University of Minnesota as well, to look at some other measures for accountability that were meant to be diagnostic and helpful. And we came up with multiple measures, and one that we're really excited about is a growth model measurement. And I'm not a psychometrician, so I'm not going to pretend to explain it, but basically we know that even when schools are not meeting AYP, there can be some really terrific things that are happening at that school. That your folks can be doing some terrific work in moving students forward and having learning happening. By the same token, we know that there are schools that need AYP, that just show up great. But guess what? They're not necessarily moving students forward and adding to their current knowledge base. And so these folks developed a tool that would be able to identify a growth model where learning is happening and allow us to diagnostically then zero in on those learning environments in order to learn more about what they're doing, with the hope that we would then take those learnings and be able to share them across the state. And so the idea here with the innovation revenue is basically that to identify, based on that growth model, learning communities, schools, where regardless of what's happening with AYP, that's still important, we're not saying it's not, but regardless of that, if there are advancements in learning that are happening, then we want to encourage that. We want to grow that. And where that isn't happening, we want those school districts then to be in a position to learn from their brother and sister learning environments. So I just want to clarify that particular piece is not an AYP connected piece, and hopefully maybe even mentioning MCLB and AYP might trigger some thoughts here from folks.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hi, my name is Chris Mills. I'm superintendent of Stephen Argyle Central. One of the issues that I have is the LEI funding. And probably the issue that I have when I look at that and look at the amount that's being funded kind of comes back to per pupil funding. We've had some per pupil funding for technology in the past, and I believe it was $5 per pupil, and for our district it came out to be about $2,000. As you know, that doesn't go very far. Our cost for a bus is the same cost for an Okanagan. And then I look at course offerings that are offered in some large schools. And our small rural schools can't touch those course offerings. And so it comes back to me, are we going to fund the basic education first and provide schools with the amount of funding we need to provide the amount of math classes and science classes, English, social studies? We need to fund that first. And I think when you get out and you look at the districts that have the tax base to run a referendum and pass it on the back of industry, rather than on the back of our farming communities and our rural areas, I really struggle with the fact that just it's a cost of living adjustment. And we struggled with that with the MREA. You compare that versus scarcity funding, but then you look at the amount, and it doesn't touch it. And so that's a real struggle. I mean, obviously, we need the funding. And so if that's what it takes to get the funding, our schools are going to say, yeah, please, because we need that. But when I see the course offerings that you can offer in some of those large schools, and we still struggle to make sure that we can get foreign language offered, or to draw some of those teachers in because our salaries are so much less, that's a real struggle. So I hope that when we look at this, it's not a political trade-off, because this funding source is, but there's been a while it's been trying to get in, and it's continued to be fought at your legislative level, because it brings an inequity again. So I hope it's not just a trade-off to get it done. I hope that balance continues and we stay with what we want to do, and that's equitable for each child in our state.
Thank you very much. And I'm glad you brought that up, because we figured that would come up at this hearing, and we did hear a little bit from Superintendent Peterson The location equity index has been around for a while, and it is part of the total package, but I wouldn't characterize it as a political trade-off necessarily, because we took it from PS Minnesota, and it actually was in Governor Pawlenty's education finance reform recommendations as well. And when PS Minnesota brought in John Myers, who was a national education finance consultant that many of you have probably heard at conferences, just like we have, he was charged with coming up with what would be the most equitable way to fund things based on the different types of students and the different types of school districts, based on research and what were the real differences, and not just, you know, doing something political so there'd be an agreement, but instead looking at the research-based cost differences. And the location equity index was actually one of those. We have the differences in special ed, kids that don't speak English, the compensatory for students, and then for the different types of districts, we have different types of funding. When we looked at first doing it, I would have liked it if the mathematics worked out for the regional centers, because I was quite aware that that would be politically much more salient, and we tried it every which way. But mathematically, honestly, the regional centers don't have the cost differentials that the metro area does in terms of housing, wages, and then the ability to purchase a teacher. And so it's an equity issue in terms of putting, you know, one teacher in front of kids, that to have some equity between how much a teacher costs in order to have that teacher be able to afford a house in the metro area. So that's why we did it. But we actually only funded it at half of what PS Minnesota recommended. We were being political with what they did, knowing it wouldn't be popular. We slashed it in half. So it isn't quite providing the equity that they recommended. But we did other things, and if we could, you know, find something that would work out for regional centers, you know, one of the things that regional centers get is great benefit from full special education funding, which is in this bill, full funding for the state formula. The regional centers tend to collect up more special ed kids than the small districts, just due to, I don't know what, if people move to a regional center, if they have a very expensive child and there's more services, or what causes it. I don't pretend to know the reason. But I have been convinced, and I look at the numbers, that regional centers have high special education costs. So when we fully fund the 68% promised special ed revenue in this bill, and then uncap the excess cost revenue, that really helps regional centers more than any other districts. But we're open to any suggestions that people have. MREA did sign off on that. I like to say there's things in this bill that everybody loves, and there's things in this bill that everybody hates. I can tell you my district hates that $500 coming off the levy referendum and going into state funding, because that's just a wash and we don't get anything for it. But I think that's fair. You know, I think it's fair because we're trying to lower property taxes, and that my homeowners get a property tax benefit from that, even though the schools get no money extra. And I'm willing to go along with that part of it, even though they hate it, because it's part of the package that's fair, you know, for all around the state. So I'm, you know, I think if we took out certain big pieces of this, then the package would start to unravel. I had the superintendent from Richfield in to see me last week, and they said, if you don't do the location equity index, then you cannot do that $500 subtractor, because that wouldn't work out for us. We would not be for this if you did that. And, you know, there's just so many pieces that PS Minnesota had some great, huge battles when they were giving us the various parts that they wanted us to fund. And I'm thankful that they did that, so we didn't have to have quite so much trouble when we came forward with this package. We did have to crunch the numbers, or I shouldn't say we did, our fiscal staff did, who are very, very bright with that sort of thing, and they made it work out. And we did have to change some things that PS Minnesota had asked for, like cutting the LEI in half,
We also did not do the small schools revenue that the PS Minnesota had recommended, and when we put the numbers to it, it did not work out if you didn't include the sparsity. And we looked at recommendations from the Education Commission of the state on that revenue. I have them with me because I thought, in case someone asked about that, I'll just flip that out. But we tried as best as we can, and I think if we, you know, take out major pieces, the agreement will evaporate. But we're willing to, you know, to try to. I'm more inclined to want to add things in if that helps, and I'll listen to that. But I think the location equity index not being in there would be a deal breaker for a lot of legislators, and I know that I would be one of them. Yes.
Can you have the microphone down? Senator Stump, please. Dr. I think Chris brought up a good point, or the superintendent brought up a good point, though. I think that's the struggle that Greater Minnesota has continually, and especially the small schools, is what does it really cost to educate a student? And how do you provide programs that make our children competitive, such as science and math and you know, some of the basics that all the children really need. And I think that, obviously, it's numbers, and I know the superintendents out there know them way better than anyone. If you have a sizable number, you can make it work out a whole lot better and easier in running a school than if you have fewer numbers. I think whether that 7,500 is the right number, I'm not sure, but I think that's the question that I think is going through a lot of smaller schools is, how do we continue to maintain programs as we start losing or have been losing populations? And it'd be interesting for the superintendents or board members that come up to testify is to talk a little bit about their declining student enrollment and what they think it actually costs to provide programs that they should provide. I think all of the schools have been cutting programs or have not been reinvesting money into things like technology or other necessities that schools should have. And so it'd be interesting to kind of get an idea. We had I don't know if we kept it, but we had a deal with superintendents who were supposed to report what it cost to educate. I believe it was 90% or 95% of the students in their schools, and consistently over the years it came out to be a number that was fairly close to the number that PS Minnesota came up with, which was about $2 billion. I think it was about $2 billion that we were underfunding our school, our education system. So it was kind of coincidental. The superintendents were complaining about this report that they had to do. But on the other hand, when they did that study, the two of them kind of came up about the same way. But I think it is, for me anyway, when I sit and listen to, are trying to put an education finance bill together, is I think it's, I mean, we talk about the possibility of program funding. So we actually pay for a science program. Doesn't matter if there's 10 people in it or 10 students in it or 20, but that program would be paid for. So if we could identify the things that are needed and then fund them, that's one approach. And I think some states do that. But we all struggle with how do we. Sparsity is great for the student or districts that get it, but for those that don't get it, it doesn't help. And if you look on that chart, you can see where one district that's, you know, within a stone's throw from Peterborough Falls gets about 30% more than Peterborough Falls gets, because they're a sparse district. But so I mean, as we think about rearranging the formula, there's a lot of factors that we can hopefully deal with and maybe come up with some new ideas. Sure.
Yes, welcome. Gary Lee.
Gary Lee from the Federal Beltran School District. Made a couple comments on Leroy's and what Chris said before I get to my real question here on the location equity index. When we first had children, we were living in the Burnsville Savage School District. And now at Federal Beltran, we have a total of 480 kids K-12. All right, that's where we at. When we moved our kids north, my kids were behind. And that's a good district, all right, at Burnsville Savage. It says something about the small class. It says something about the small, you know, teachers that have been in the same school for a long time. My kids have had some of the same teachers that I had when I lived in Fertile. All right, so that's good. Trying to remember some of the other comments he made. The problem, or one other thing that I've been working on is with the Wayzata Schools system. We had a thing called Common Ground where we could work on issues together. You know, one of the smallest districts in the state with one of the biggest and most richest districts in the state. And this whole issue of programs. We've completely got rid of our foreign language program. Couldn't afford it. We just had to get rid of it. We have a great math program. We have a great, you know, fundamental programs, but these other ones that Wayzata can provide is nothing that we can provide. We have great music, but we don't have orchestra. We don't have the kids for one thing. Right? So there are things that are happening in small districts, whether you're in Steelton or you're in Fertile or down in the southwest corner or whatever, that are really good. And you're exactly right when it comes to, can we have those basic programs that we need? And I wouldn't move my kids back to the cities for nothing. All right, I mean, I just, you know, but they're getting a good education up here, and we're struggling with the basics is what we're struggling with. My real question that I came up here for was, what is your bill going to do with, you know, crises as they come along, the current crisis being fuel? And what it's going to cost a small district or a large district for transportation and to heat the building. You know, we're going to have these problems on and off again. And so when things like this happen, will your bill address that, or are you as an education committee going to look at that right now? Because all our costs are more than doubling, which means for a school like Fertile, that's another program. That's another teacher or two that are going to have to be dealt with. So thanks.
Thank you very much. When we were in White Bear Lake, the superintendent, who was retiring, by the way, so he could say what he wanted, he said, this bill isn't enough. You know, it's not enough. He said, you're not, if you stretch it out over three bienniums to phase it in, then it's really only an inflationary increase, and so we need more. That was one of his comments. So, I think, going to have to fight really hard to get this beginning to phase. And then we are tying it to inflation if we get to pass it the way we have, that we are proposing it. And then beyond that, if there are extra problems, you know, the legislature can always change. We can do something one year and a whole new crop of legislators can come in and do something else. That's the problem with how we fund education. This bill, part of the PS Minnesota goal, was to have the formula be stable and predictable and that you could count on it. And to not have us come in and try this one year and this another year, but instead to have a formula that everybody agreed on, at least the compromise, and then that it was tied to inflation and funded. Beyond that, if the legislature saw a fuel crisis or an energy crisis or any kind of problems at all that cost a lot of money, obviously asbestos funding, there's funding for that. Different types of funding can always be considered by the legislature. But I guess I wouldn't predict that while we're working on this, we're going to be
doing too many other types of funding, because facing a $2 billion deficit, I think to get started on this is a very ambitious goal for our finance committee alone. Okay, welcome. Okay, welcome. And Carol. Okay. Carol Eilish.
Hi, I'm Carol Eilish. I'm the curriculum testing staff development title director, and he just hit the magic word when he started talking about AYP, which I left behind, to get me started. Actually, the one comment you made, I had to really strongly agree with, the idea of the grants that you talked about that were not necessarily tied to AYP. We are a district that has been very fortunate and not been on the AYP hit list, although we are this year. But there have been so many grant opportunities that have come across my desk, email, et cetera, we're doing okay, but we're not doing that great. We would love to be able to apply for some of these innovative grants, et cetera, but we're not eligible for them because we haven't been on that AYP list for several years. So we're really punished for doing well as far as trying to get some additional funding to do some innovative things. So I would encourage that piece of it. And just in regards to the growth model, I know you said you're not a psychometrician, and I'm not either, but so many schools in the state of Minnesota currently use NWEA, which is a growth model, and that is it's very well documented. It's an excellent resource for schools, and I would say probably about 90% of schools are currently using it because it does give us the information we want related to growth. And just an editorial comment that our state spends millions and millions and millions every year on developing these assessments, and from most people's perspective, they're not as good and don't give us the information that we get from the NWEA assessments. And one more comment related to state testing, and I know that's not your issue totally, but in all of the schools across the state of Minnesota have to spend an exorbitant amount of time and resources to administer these state tests. And it grows every year. So it involves many, many staff that takes away from the task at hand as far as providing educational opportunities for kids. We're kind of caught in the details, the minutia of all the testing. And it's not just testing coordinators. It's all the administrators. It's teachers. It's a ton of extra work that we have to do with that, so we don't have time to deal with kid issues. So that's it.
Thank you very much. Wayne, and I'll let you
pronounce
your last
name. Hi, I'm Wayne Kazmich. I'm from the Morgan School District. I'm the assistant superintendent there, and I just wanted to share a little bit from our perspective, bordering North Dakota. Several things came to mind. The Fargo-Moorhead area has been growing tremendously the last decade or more. I remember working in the construction industry 15 years ago in that area with the boom, and it seems to not have really stalled even during the national downturn here. All day kindergarten is now funded in North Dakota, and if you're not familiar with Moorhead, it's right on the border, so it's a stone's throw from Fargo and West Fargo. So that's an issue we're dealing with. We're not able to provide that. We did study that, but we were not able. We thought we couldn't come up with a tuition-based model when our neighbors were able to offer that for free for parents. So that's something we're going to take up again, and hopefully we're going to be able to figure it out, but I don't know how. For this current school year, 2008-09, we did reduce our roughly $59 operating budget by $1 million, and we did that by not touching the classroom. That was our objective. We cut technology. We didn't buy a school bus. We cut capital projects. We did all those things that are short-term fix. Well, we're going to have to buy a school bus, and we're going to have a roof that springs a leak, and we're quite worried about that, actually, because in another couple of years, we aren't going to have the fund balance to be able to pay for that type of an issue. as we look ahead to 2009-10, we don't know what number yet, but we're looking at anywhere from $2 to $3 million in reductions. We're already looking at class sizes that are approaching 30 in our elementaries, and again, we're competing for families to move into Minnesota. We're a regional center, about a 40,000 population for a district, about 5,400 students. So we're competing with families that are moving to the Fargo-Moorhead area. So when we go to our voters and ask for a tax increase, we also have to take into account our neighbors across the river. Our $39.80. A regional center, about a 40,000 population for a district, about 5,400 students. So we're competing with families that are moving to the Fargo-Moorhead area. So when we go to our voters and ask for a tax increase, we also have to take into account our neighbors across the river. Our $39.80 excess operating levy expires in a year. That compares to $750 average in the state, and of districts of similar size, probably more like $1,200 to $1,500. So for us, that would be anywhere from $7 to $10 million more per year. So anyway, that's our focus right now. We just hired a new superintendent. Our main focus this next year is our budget reduction process, and that's kind of a sad state of affairs. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is Moorhead a growing district, or is it?
We haven't seen the school age population increase over the last few years. There's been a lot of building, but we haven't seen the associated increase in student enrollment. We're stable. So we're hoping there are a lot of little ones that just haven't gotten into our system yet, but we haven't seen it.
So. How about the student mix?
I think fairly typical for outstates, the free and reduced population, about 30%, 80% Caucasian, 20% non. So.
And part of this bill is to have funding for all the kindergarten for all districts. So that is part of having every student count as one would mean all the kindergarten for all districts. And those that are already offering it then, of course, would get, they would just get the extra money for something they're already doing that they then could use for other things. We have 3 more minutes. We could hear from one more person, or we could adjourn 3 minutes early. So what is your pleasure? 3 minutes early. All the legislators, we can stay a while if you want to ask us things individually. Thank you so much for your testimony and for coming tonight.